This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
In 1990, Japan served as a founding member of the International Council on Harmonization. The ICH was established to achieve greater harmonization worldwide to ensure that safe, effective, and high-quality medicines are developed and registered in the most resource-efficient manner. As we step into the post-COVID-19 world, the goal of ensuring the most efficient development of quality medicines is perhaps more important than ever. How are the clinical research, drug development, and pharmaceutical industries in Japan responding to this challenge? I am Alberto Grignolo, Editor-in-Chief of DIA Global Forum. Today, we welcome Dr. Stuart Geary, Global Safety Officer and a Senior Vice President at Eisai Company Limited. Stuart is a counselor of the Japanese Association of Pharmaceutical Medicine, a fellow of DIA, a fellow of the Academy of Physicians in Clinical Research, and chair of DIA's Japan Annual Meeting 2021. Stuart, thank you for joining us today and welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
First question, why are COVID vaccine approvals slower in Japan and vaccination rates lower in Japan compared to most Western countries?
It's a great question, although I have to say that the real miracle is that we had vaccine approvals so quickly after the initiation of the pandemic and that the UK and the US were able to do those approvals so quickly. So if you think about the actual timelines for review, the UK approval came on, I think, December 2nd after about 2 months of review. And the Japanese approval on February 14th of 2021 was also within an under two-month review of the submission package for the first vaccine, which was approved in Japan. Now, as you know, Japan is always very interested in having data from Japan that shows both efficacy and safety for any drug approval, and that's going to be true for vaccines as well. Japan was still faced with the problem that during 2020, we had very few COVID cases here in Japan. You really didn't have enough COVID cases to do a good efficacy trial of a vaccine. And there were, I think, a number of domestic vaccine trials which did not succeed in 2020 because there was a lack of patients. If you look at the first vaccine which was approved in Japan, the Comirnaty vaccine approval, it does show phase 1-2 data in a Japanese population in about 150 or so healthy volunteers, showing just the blood results that would suggest you were going to have some kind of an antibody response from the vaccine. But the longer section on the clinical efficacy is just giving the global data without any breakout of the Japanese safety or efficacy data. So you really have here a case where Japan is approving a vaccine where the pivotal data is really essentially all from outside Japan. And as you know, that can be a challenge for regulators in this country. And I think that it's amazing that they were still able to do that approval relatively quickly after a two-month review to really in just February of this year.
And what now, about the vaccination rates? Are they in fact lower than they might be or should be?
We're up to about 50% of people being vaccinated in Japan. And for instance, if you take my example, I'm a very motivated, wanting to be vaccinated person. I didn't receive my second dose of vaccine until September 1st. And there are a few reasons I think that the rollout in Japan has been a little bit slower than I think would have been ideal. One is you needed to have a ticket in order to get vaccinated effectively. Those tickets were kind of rolled out with the idea that you would first vaccinate the elderly, people who are working in direct patient care, and then roll that out later on for people who are of younger and younger ages. And that rollout took some time. I think a second issue, which is maybe underappreciated in the US, is Japan did not have enough doses to vaccinate people right away if they'd had everything running perfectly in February. They have about 126 million population here. That'd be about a 250 million doses worth of vaccine. And these are vaccines which, in many cases, because of storage requirements, you're going to lose some during the actual vaccination process from unused vials. So you saw, I think, in Japan reported very publicly, the Japanese prime minister calling the CEO of one of the prominent vaccine makers, I think on two occasions, to try to secure an extra 100 million doses of vaccine. So I think that getting the full amount in the country was one issue. Another and probably a more serious problem for Japan was the requirements for vaccination are actually pretty strict here. And vaccinations had to be done under physician supervision. And there really was not an easy way to convert the medical care system to be doing that under physician supervision very quickly, unfortunately. So I know that when I was vaccinated, I was eventually vaccinated in a center that was basically a sports center from my local the local section of Tokyo where I live. And when I was vaccinated, they had a very efficient process of running people through it. But there were three people present when I was vaccinated. There was an elderly, pretty clearly retired physician across the table from me watching me get vaccinated. There was, I think, a nurse to my left putting the needle in my arm. And there was someone else holding up my shirt so that I could get the vaccination smoothly at the time I was getting vaccinated. So you really had a little bit of a maybe an excess use of manpower for vaccines. But you know, once it happened, it was a pretty efficient and I think a very careful and carefully monitored process, but perhaps a little bit more manpower intensive than you typically would have seen for vaccinations in the US.
Thank you, Stuart. More generally, has the pandemic changed clinical research and clinical care in Japan in the past 18 months or so?
I think we've seen some changes and maybe wish we could see some more changes. So we've had certainly some of the unfortunate effects I think you've seen in other countries, in that during 2020, it became a very difficult time to initiate a clinical trial. It became a difficult time to recruit patients to clinical trials, which were ongoing, especially if those were clinical trials in patients who were elderly, or for instance, in cancer therapies, where patients were not going to the hospital to be diagnosed very quickly and were a little bit reluctant to go to hospitals, even though we had very few cases in Japan. So I think you did see some negative impacts in that sense. The healthcare system in Japan has had one big challenge in that a lot of people are concentrated in large cities, and that's also where healthcare professionals are concentrated. But you have a large elderly population, which is still in the countryside, in towns which are kind of dying off, which are very small and are probably underserved by healthcare professionals. And because of that, there had been an ongoing debate about telehealth to try to allow people in those cities who are working as physicians to, in a telehealth kind of sense, contact patients outside of the major cities. And that was not allowed in Japan until 2020. But despite that being green-lighted last year, you've had really very little uptake of that in Japan. So we really have not seen much uptake of telehealth in Japan. I suspect that might be actually a little bit of reluctance on the part of patients who like to see their physicians in person and frequently in Japan, but also perhaps a little bit of reluctance on the part of physicians. So we really have not had as much adoption of telehealth as you might wish in the country. And I think we have, as we're highlighting in some of our sessions for the DIA meeting here in Japan, there has been some adoption of more techniques for instance, doing kind of a virtual inspections of clinical trial sites and using kind of electronic means to do things not in person for clinical trials and some of the panoply of things we have to do to make sure that we're getting correct data for clinical trials. That is getting adopted here in Japan. But again, I think it's kind of early days.
Stuart, moving to your particular area of expertise, drug safety, clearly, there has been a great emphasis on safety of treatments and vaccines in the past 18 months for the well-known reasons. In Japan, have you seen any changes in pharmacovigilance practices during the pandemic? Are there things that have not changed but perhaps should change?
Yes. Well, as you know, we have a little bit of an unusual way of collecting most of our adverse event reports in Japan, and they're largely coming through the MRs who are visiting hospitals and pharmacies and getting the initial report, either if it's a spontaneous report or even in some of our post-marketing observational studies. Those were often coming through MRs. Now, with the pandemic, even though we did not have too many cases in Japan, there was really a complete shutdown of access of MR staff to hospitals. And we saw the numbers of adverse event reports from spontaneous reporting drop very, very significantly in the early months of the pandemic. Went really Wow. down to a tiny fraction of what they had been. After that, though, they did build up again. Our MRs are still largely not visiting hospitals, but they are receiving those reports through electronic communications with physicians. As you may also know, in Japan, we have the EPPV, the Early Phase Pharmacovigilance System, where when we have a new approval for a drug or a new approval for a new indication for a drug, for the first 6 months, we need to send someone to each site where you could potentially be prescribing that drug to remind them about the safety profile and the need to report serious adverse reactions. And of course, an EPPV program would be very difficult to perform if you're not allowed to actually go to the facility.
That's right.
With some kind of bumpiness, we've been able to actually in some way do EPPV visits, either in person or virtually. What before the pandemic was probably a 90 to 100% rate of visiting the institutions is down to about 70 to 90%. But we are now able to do those EPPV programs, kind of adapting some of the techniques we would use to work with sites.
Given that the safety reporting was a fraction of normal, if you will, as I believe you stated, is there a broad concern about underreporting of adverse events in connection with the pandemic period?
We had underreporting for a few months, but we did catch up. And I think that there may have been a little bit of an underutilization of pharmaceuticals to some sense as well during some of the early days of the pandemic. I think that this is maybe calling into some question about the use of the MR in the safety process in Japan. Even though I think we will always in Japan think that one of the MR's primary jobs is to communicate safety and assist with gathering safety information, there are now some discussions about perhaps not requiring that the emergency letters we have, the blue letter or yellow letter we have in Japan for emergency safety communications, that those perhaps do not need to go through the MR in the future. And perhaps we would not use the MRs for the CHOSA, the observational studies we do post-marketing in Japan. That was already a little bit under discussion before the pandemic, but I think we're having some serious discussions about maybe that changing in Japan going forward. That would be a change in GPP probably, but that is at least being discussed. There's another issue though that we've had in Japan that I think the pandemic has really brought to light, and that is the way we report events in Japan spontaneously. So in the US, when you process a spontaneous case for reporting to the FDA, and largely for Europe as well, that can go from the company to the FDA without the company giving you a large analysis of the case or company comment on causality. But under Japanese GBP, when we report, we need to have some form of company comment on the causality of the event that we're reporting to the agency. And with the vaccine rollouts and now reporting cases from around the world, I think the companies that are involved in the marketing of vaccines in Japan, and my company is not one of them, but they have really been overwhelmed with the numbers of reports that are going to the PMDA just for the routine things we expect from vaccines and the need to have this extra Japanese step. And I think people are really calling into question the value of that requirement that you have a company comment, both because of the reporting company as well as the agency. How is the agency going to be really evaluating 100,000 cases like that in a matter of a few weeks with a company comment? It's perhaps not realistic for the way we actually practice pharmacovigilance.
The pandemic certainly has had devastating effects, but it has also had other effects in bringing to the surface issues and possibilities that were discussed informally before the pandemic and then have become more mainstream. For example, decentralized clinical trials to make clinical trials more convenient for patients. So turning to the patient in particular, are clinical trials in Japan incorporating the voice of the patient? Are sponsors and investigators listening to patients in the context of clinical research, more so perhaps than in the past, or has this not changed?
I think it's a great question. It's also something I think that I personally need to be doing a little bit work on for myself in terms of how we would actually do this in Japan. I think that we're starting in a different place in Japan compared to the US and parts of Europe when we're talking about the patient voice in the drug development process and post-marketing. Keep in mind that we don't have the process in Japan of, for instance, direct-to-consumer advertising or a lot of direct company contact with patients, except for the hotlines we have where patients can ask questions of the company about drugs or report adverse events to us directly. And we still get a tiny fraction of our reports from patients directly. In fact, the PMDA allows direct reporting of adverse events by patients to the agency, and that amounts to no more than a couple hundred cases a year. Think about how that compares with the FDA's experience in direct reporting. The PMDA has, however, started a patient participation working group that started in 2019. And I think that there's a lot of interest in seeing how that would play out both for the clinical development process as well as post-marketing communication from patients or patient involvement. But I think we still have a lot of work to do in Japan to truly incorporate the patient voice in our design or conduct of clinical trials.
You spoke of the regulators being sometimes overwhelmed by the inputs from industry, a lot of extra information, a lot of extra work in relation to vaccines and treatments for COVID, et cetera. So in the broader context, have the Japanese regulators, PMDA and MHLW, been able to keep up? Or have they been slowed down by the pandemic? Has working from home been an impediment or maybe a facilitation? Because then commuting times are vastly reduced or non-existent. How have the regulators responded through this time? Are they keeping up?
I think overall, the regulators are doing a pretty good job of keeping up. I think that they are not working from home as often as we are in companies. Probably, I think in the PMDA, they're doing that a little bit. I'm not sure in the MHLW that people are really working from home for the MHLW. It's a very traditional mindset for working in some of the government agencies. I think that they have been having to struggle, you know, with the amount of data that's being put to the regulators for dealing with the pandemic. And just as you've seen in other countries, you've seen in Japan cases of things being approved early related to the pandemic and then getting modifications of those approvals. That's been, I think, an issue for us here in Japan. we have in Japan what's called the Special Approval for Emergency System, which was kind of designed for an emergency where you needed to do an approval for something that wasn't approved in Japan. But that system actually has not been used very much during the pandemic because it has a few conditions. It has to be done for a drug which is approved elsewhere. So it meant you couldn't really in Japan jump ahead of the US or European regulators in approval. You had to base your SAFE, your safe approval, on that external approval. And it also prevented you from doing anything different about the post-marketing surveillance for the approval. So that system has not been used very much. Instead, we've been using what's called the Tokarei system for doing a kind of an accelerated approval, but that has the same sort of requirements for the panoply of post-marketing surveillance as we do in Japan and the risk management plans, et cetera. So it's been a struggle, I think, for the regulator to use the tools they have, and that there may be some kind of a re-examination of the tools we have in Japan for our emergency approvals.
It's a bit curious to me that Japan, seeing itself as an innovator, would want to depend on the approvals of other major authorities before approving a product for emergency use. I find that a little bit curious in the context of Japan wanting to be seen as an innovative country.
And I think that the reason for that is that the special approval for emergency system was really a special system with one kind of presumption. And it dates back to, I think, the years of the drug lag in Japan, where you had a concern from physicians and patients in Japan about not being able to use drugs in Japan, which were approved and common in medical practice outside Japan. Hence, you were having that kind of assumption that you'd had another kind of ICH level regulator had actually approved the drug before it would be approved in Japan based solely on that evidence.
And finally, Stuart, in the area of drug pricing, what new developments or challenges do the industries in drug development and pharmaceuticals face in Japan? Are drug pricing pressures severe? And if so, are they too severe from the standpoint of the industry?
I think that they've always been severe. There have always been issues with drug pricing in Japan. And I think people are feeling that a little bit more keenly as time goes on. The industry position on drug pricing in Japan, it seems a little bit unfair because it's a relatively easy target for the government compared to other parts of the medical care system that could be controlled for cost savings when, you know, the medical care system, of course, is an expensive thing and difficult to maintain. From an industry perspective, what we would like to be doing is doing more in generating quality of life data and other evidence which shows the real value the drugs are providing to Japan. Because what happens right now is, if a drug is innovative in a way which we have not had for prior drugs, it is allowed to have a premium price to some extent. But once one drug has that, other drugs are not getting that premium price in the same field. And then, of course, Japan has a system where those prices are set at one point at launch, and from then on will be ratcheted down. And the system allows ratcheting down more quickly than every 2 years, the previous system, if the drug is very popular. So the pricing pressures are applied really based on the amount of use of the drug, and they can ratchet down that price pretty quickly, which I think is seen in Japan as kind of a punishment for innovation as opposed to encouraging innovation for these very resource-intense new medical products that we are producing.
Okay. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that Japan has established a system of comparative effectiveness assessment to assess the value of medicines in the broader context. Is that correct? And how does that play out?
Yes, and I think that that's part of the data that's going into making a decision about whether a drug deserves a price which is premium compared to other treatments in that therapeutic area.
Well, Stuart, those were all of my questions. I thank you for your time and deep insights today. I know you've lived in Japan for a long time. I know you to be completely fluent in Japanese. I've seen you lecture in Japanese without notes, always very impressive. But again, thank you for your time today and good luck with DIA Japan 2021.
Thank you very much.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.